And for what? To serve the sick, to teach her faith. Always humble, always respectful. She'd never broken her vows of poverty, chastity, and obedience. Maudi was sure of that. And though those vows and those beliefs might have been false, they hadn't been that false. He'd learned from her the same thing that the prophet had learned. There was but one God. There was but one book. She had served both with a pure heart, however misguided her religious beliefs might have been. Not just Sister Jean-Baptiste, he reminded himself. Sister Maria Magdalena, too. And she had been murdered. And why? Loyalty to her faith, loyalty to her vows, loyalty to her friend, not one of which the Holy Koran found the least bit objectionable. It would have been so much easier for him had he only worked with black Africans. Their religious beliefs were things the Koran abhorred, since many of them were still pagans in deed, if not in word, ignorant of the one God. And he could easily have looked down on them, and not worried at all about Christians. But he had met Jean-Baptiste and Maria Magdalena. Why? Why had that happened? Unfortunately for him, it was too late to ask such questions. What was past. Maudi walked to the far corner of the room and got himself some coffee. He'd been awake for more than a day, and with fatigue came doubts. And he hoped the drink would chase them away until sleep could come. And with it, rest. And with that, perhaps, peace.
"You have to be kidding!" Arnie snarled into the phone.
Tom Donner's voice was as apologetic as it could be.
"Maybe it was the metal detectors on the way out. The tape, I mean, it's damaged. You can still see it and hear it just fine, but there's a little noise on the audio track. Not broadcast quality. The whole hour's worth is shot. We can't use it."
"So?" Van Damme demanded. "So we have a problem, Arnie. The segment is supposed to run at 9. "So what do you want me to do about it?" "Is Ryan up to redoing it live?" "We'll get better share that way," the anchor man offered.
The president's chief of staff almost said something else. If this had been sweeps week, during which the networks did their best to inflate their audiences in order to get additional commercial fees, he might have accused Donner of having done this deliberately.
No, that was a line even he couldn't cross. Dealing with the press on this level was rather like being Clyde Beatty in center ring, armed with a bottomless chair and a blank-loaded revolver, holding great jungle cats at bay for the audience, having the upper hand at all times, but knowing that the cats needed to get lucky only once. Instead, he just offered silence, forcing Donner to make the next move.
"Look, Arnie, it'll be the same agenda. How often do we give the president a chance to rehearse his lines? And he did fine this morning. John thinks so, too."
"You can't retape?" Van Damme asked.
"Arnie, I go on the air in 40 minutes, and I'm wrapped till 7:30. That gives me 30 minutes to scoot down to the White House, set up and shoot, and get the tape back here, all before 9. You want to lend me one of his helicopters?"
He paused.
"This way. Tell you what. I will say on the air that we goofed on the tape, and that the boss graciously agreed to go live with us. If that isn't a network blowjob, I don't know what is."
Arnold Van Damme's alarm lights were all flashing red. The good news was that Jack had handled himself pretty well. Not perfect, but pretty well, especially on the sincerity. Even the controversial stuff, he'd come across as believing what he'd said. Ryan took coaching well, and he learned fast. He hadn't looked as relaxed as he should, but that was okay. Ryan wasn't a politician. He'd said that 2 or 3 times. And therefore looking a little tense was all right. Focus groups in 7 different cities all said that they liked Jack because he acted like one of them. Ryan didn't know that Arnie and the political staff were doing that. That little program was as secret as a CIA operation, but Arnie justified it to himself as a reality check on how the president could best project his agenda and his image in order to govern effectively,
and no president had ever known all the things done in his name.
So, yes, Ryan did come across as presidential. Not in the normal way, but in his own way, and that, the focus groups all agreed, was good, too. And going live, yes, that would really look good, and it would get a lot more people to flip the channel to NBC. And Arnie wanted the people to get to know Ryan better.
Okay, Tom, a tentative yes, but I do have to ask him.
Fast, please, Donna replied. If he cancels out, then we have to jerk around the whole network schedule for tonight, and that could mean my ass, okay?
Back to you in 5, Van Damme promised. He killed the button on the phone and hustled out of the room, leaving the receiver on his desk pad. On the way to see the boss, he told the Secret Service agents in the east-west corridor. His stride told them to jump out of his way, even before they saw his eyes.
"Yes," Ryan said.
It wasn't often his door opened without warning.
"We have to redo the interview," Arnie said, somewhat breathlessly.
Jack shook his head in surprise.
"Why, didn't I have my fly zipped?"
"Mary always checks that. The tape got screwed up, and there isn't time to reshoot. So Donner asked me to ask you if you would do it live at 9 o'clock. Same questions and everything."
"No, no," Arnie said, thinking fast. "What about we get your wife down here, too?"
"Kathy won't like that."
"Why?" the president asked.
"Really, all she has to do is sit there and smile. It will look good for the people out there. Jack, she has to act like the first lady occasionally. This should be an easy one. Maybe we can even bring the kids in toward the end."
"No. My kids stay out of the public eye, period. Kathy and I have talked about that."
"But—" "No, Arnie. No now, no tomorrow, no in the future. No."
Ryan's voice was as final as a death sentence.
The chief of staff figured he couldn't talk Ryan into everything. This would take a little time, but he'd come around eventually. You couldn't be one of the people without letting them meet your kids. But now wasn't the time to press on that one.
"Will you ask Kathy?"
Ryan sighed and nodded.
"Okay."
"Right, okay. I'll tell Donner that she might be on, but we're not sure yet because of her medical obligations. It'll give him something to think about. It will also take some of the heat off you. That's the First Lady's main job, remember?" "You want to tell her that, Arnie? Remember, she's a surgeon, good with knives." Van Damme laughed. "I'll tell you what she is. She's a hell of a lady, and she's tougher than either one of us. Ask nicely," he advised. "Yeah." Right before dinner, Jack thought. "Okay, he'll do it. But we want to ask his wife to join us, too."
"Why?"
"Why not?" Arnie asked. "Not sure yet. She isn't back from work," he added. And that was a line that made the reporters smile. "Okay, Arnie, thanks. I owe you one." Donner turned off the speakerphone. "You realize that you just lied to the President of the United States," John Plummer observed pensively. Plummer was an older pro than Donner. He wasn't of the Edward R. Murrow generation, quite. Pushing 70 now, he'd been a teenager in World War II, but had gone to Korea as a young reporter, and been foreign correspondent in London, Paris, Bonn, and finally Moscow. Plummer had been ejected from Moscow, and his somewhat left political stance had nonetheless never turned into sympathy with the Soviet Union. But more than that, though he was not of Murrow's generation, he had grown up listening to the immortal CBS correspondent, and he could still close his eyes and hear the gravelly voice which had somehow carried a measure of authority usually associated with the clergy.
Maybe it was because Ed had started on the radio, when one's voice was the currency of the profession.
He'd certainly known language better than most of his own time, and infinitely better than the semi-literate reporters and newswriters of the current generation. Plummer was something of a scholar in his own right, a devoted student of Elizabethan literature, and he tried to draft his copy and his spontaneous comments with an elegance in keeping with that of the teacher he'd only watched and heard, but never actually met. More than anything else, people had listened to Ed Murrow because of his honor,
John Plummer reminded himself. He'd been as tough as any of the later generation of investigative journalists that the schools turned out now, but you always knew that Ed Murrow was fair. And you knew that he didn't break the rules. Plummer was of the generation that believed that his profession was supposed to have rules, one of which was you never told a lie. You could bend, warp, and twist the truth in order to get information out of someone. That was different. But you never told someone something that was deliberately and definitely false. That troubled John Plummer. Ed would never have done that. Not a chance. John, he rolled us.
You think?
The information I got. Well, what do you think? It had been a frantic 2 hours with the entire network research staff running down bits of such minor trivia that even two or three of the pieces, put together, didn't amount to much of anything. But they'd all checked out, and that was something else entirely.
I'm not sure, Tom.
Plummer rubbed his eyes.
Is Ryan a little out of his depth?
Yes, he is.
But is he trying pretty hard?
Definitely.
Is he honest?
I think so.
Well, as honest as any of them ever can be, he amended himself.
Then we'll give him the chance to prove it, won't we? Plummer didn't say anything. Visions of ratings and maybe even an Emmy were dancing in the eyes of his junior colleague like sugar plums on Christmas Eve. In any case, Donner was the anchor, and Plummer was the commentator. And Tom had the ear of the front office in New York, which had once been peopled by men of his own generation, but was now entirely populated by people of Donner's, businessmen more than journalists, who saw ratings as the holy grail on their quarterly earnings statements.
Well, Ryan liked businessmen, didn't he?
I suppose.
The helicopter landed on the South Lawn pad. The crew chief jerked the door open and jumped out, next helping the first lady out with a smile. Her portion of the detail followed, walking up the gentle slope to the south entrance, then to the elevator, where Roy Altman pushed the button for her, since the first lady wasn't allowed to do that either.
"Surgeon is in the elevator, heading for the residence," Agent Raymond reported from the ground floor.
"Roger," Andrea Price acknowledged upstairs.
She'd already had some people from the technical security unit check all the metal detectors the NBC crew had passed on the way out. The TSU chief commented that occasionally they got a little fluky, and the large-format beta tapes the networks used could easily be damaged. But he didn't think so.
"Maybe a line surge?" she'd asked.
"No chance," he'd replied, reminding her archly that even the air in the White House was checked continuously by his people. Andrea debated discussing that with the chief of staff, but it would have been no use. Damn the reporters anyway. They were the biggest pain in the ass on the campus.
"Hi, Andrea," Kathy said, breezing past her.
"Hello, Dr. Ryan. Dinner is just coming up now."
"Thank you," Surgeon replied on her way into the bedroom.
She stopped on entering, seeing that a dress and jewelry were on her valet. Frowning, she kicked off her shoes and got casual clothes for dinner, wondering, as always, if there were cameras hidden somewhere to record the event. The White House cook, George Butler, was by far her superior. He'd even improved on her spinach salad, adding a pinch of rosemary to the dressing she'd perfected over the years. Kathy kibitzed with him at least once a week, and in turn he showed her how to use the institutional-class appliances. She sometimes wondered how good a cook she might have become had she not opted for medicine. The executive chef hadn't told her that she had a gift for it, being fearful of patronizing her. Surgeon was a surgeon, after all. Along the way he'd learned the family preferences, and cooking for a toddler, he'd discovered, was a treat, especially when she occasionally came down with her towering bodyguard to search for snacks. Don Russell and she had milk and cookies at least twice a week. Sandbox had become the darling of the staff.
"Mommy," Katie Ryan said when Kathy came through the door.
"Hi, honey." Sandbox got the first hug and kiss. POTUS got the second. The older kids resisted, as always.
"Jack, why are my clothes out?"
"We're going to be on TV tonight," Swordsman replied warily.
"Why?"
"The tape from this morning got all farbled up, and they want to do it live at 9. And if you're willing, I want you to be there, too."
"To answer what?"
"About what you'd expect, as far as I'm concerned."
"So what do I do, walk in with a tray of cookies?"
"George makes the best cookies," Sandbox added to the conversation. The other kids laughed. It broke the tension somewhat. "You don't have to if you don't want, but Arnie thinks it's a good idea."
"Great," Kathy observed.
Her head tilted as she looked at her husband. Sometimes she wondered where the puppet strings were, the ones Arnie used to jerk her husband around. Bondarenko was working late, or early, depending on one's point of view. He'd been at his desk for 20 hours, and since his promotion to general officer, he'd learned that life was far better as a colonel. As a colonel, he'd gotten out to jog, and even managed to sleep with his wife most of the time. Now, he'd always aspired to higher rank. He'd always had ambition, else why would a Signal Corps officer have gone into the Afghan mountains with the Spetsnaz? Recognized for his talent, his colonelcy had almost been his undoing, as he'd worked as a close aide for another colonel who'd turned out to be a spy. That fact still boggled him. Misha Filitov, a spy for the West? It had shaken his faith in many things, most of all his faith in his country. But then the country had died. The Soviet Union, which had raised him and uniformed him and trained him, had died one cold December night, to be replaced with something smaller and more comfortable to serve. It was easier to love Mother Russia than a huge polyglot empire. Now it was as though the adopted children had all moved away, and the true children remained, and that made for a happier family. But a poorer one. Why hadn't he seen it before? His country's military had been the world's largest and most impressive, or so he had once thought, with its huge masses of men and arms, and its proud history of destroying the German invaders in history's most brutal war. But that military had died in Afghanistan, or if not quite that, then lost its soul and its confidence, as America's had done in Vietnam. But America had recovered, a process his country had yet to begin. All that money wasted. Wasted on the departed provinces, those ungrateful wretches whom the Union had supported for generations, now gone, taking so much wealth with them, and in some cases turning away to join with others. Then, he feared, to turn back as enemies. Just like unfaithful, adopted children. Golovko was right. If that danger was to be stopped, it had to be stopped early. But how? Dealing with a few bandit Chechens had proved difficult enough. He was operations chief now. In 5 more years he'd be commanding general. Bondarenko had no illusions about that. He was the best officer of his age group, and his performance in the field had won him high-level attention, ever the determining factor in the ultimate advancement. He could get that job just in time to fight Russia's last losing battle. Or maybe not. In 5 years, given funding and a free hand to reshape doctrine and training, he might just convert the Russian army into a force such as it had never been. He would shamelessly use the American model, as the Americans had shamelessly used Soviet tactical doctrine in the Persian Gulf War. But for that to happen, he needed a few years of relative peace. If his forces were to be trapped into fighting brush fires all along its southern periphery, he would not have the needed time or funding to save the army. So what was he supposed to do? He was the operations chief. He was supposed to know. It was his job to know. Except he didn't. Turkmenistan was first. If he didn't stop it there, he never would. On the left side of his desk was a roster of available divisions and brigades, with their supposed states of readiness. On the right side was a map. The two made a poor match.
"You have such nice hair," Mary Abbott said. "I didn't do surgery today," Kathy explained. "The cap always ruins it." "You've had the same hairstyle for how long?"
"Since we got married."
"Never changed it?"
That surprised Mrs. Abbott. Kathy just shook her head. She thought that she looked rather like the actress Susanna York, or at least she'd liked the look from a movie she'd seen while in college. And the same was true of Jack, wasn't it? He'd never changed his haircut, except when he didn't have the time to get a trim, something else the White House staff took care of every 2 weeks. They were far better at managing Jack's life than she'd ever been. They probably just did things and scheduled things instead of asking first, as she had always done. A much more efficient system, Kathy told herself. She was more nervous than she let on, worse than the first day of medical school, worse than her first surgical procedure, when she'd had to close her eyes and scream inwardly at her hands to keep them from shaking. But at least they'd listened then, and they listened now, too. Okay, she thought, that was the key. This was a surgical procedure, and she was a surgeon, and a surgeon was always in control.
"I think that does it," Mrs. Abbott said. "Thank you. Do you like working with Jack?"
An insider's smile.
"He hates makeup."
"But most men do," she allowed.
"I have a secret for you."
"So do I."
"I didn't do much," Mary observed at once. "Your skin doesn't need much."
The woman-to-woman observation made Dr. Ryan smile.
"Thank you. Can I make a suggestion?"
"Sure."
"Let your hair grow another inch, maybe two. It would complement the shape of your face better."
"That's what Elaine says. She's my hairdresser in Baltimore.
I tried it once. The surgical caps make it all scrunchy."
"We can make bigger caps for you. We try to take care of our first ladies."
"Oh.
And why didn't I think of that?" Kathy asked herself. It had to be cheaper than taking the helicopter to work.
"Thank you."
"This way." Mrs. Abbott led Flotus to the Oval Office. Surprisingly, Kathy had been in the room only twice before, and only once to see Jack there. It suddenly struck her as odd. Her bedroom wasn't 50 yards away from her husband's place of work, after all. The desk struck her as grossly old-fashioned, but the office itself was huge and airy compared to hers at Hopkins, even now with the TV lights and cameras set up. Over the mantel, opposite the desk, was what the Secret Service called the world's most photographed plant. The furniture was too formal to be comfortable, and the rug with the president's seal embroidered on it was downright tacky, she thought. But it wasn't a normal office for a normal person.
"Hi, honey."
Jack kissed her and handled introductions.
"This is Tom Donner and John Plummer."
"Hello."
Kathy smiled.
"I used to listen to you while fixing dinner."
"Not anymore," Plummer asked with a smile.
"No TV in the dining room upstairs, and they won't let me fix dinner."
"Doesn't your husband help?" Donner asked.
"Jack in the kitchen. Well, he's okay on a grill, but the kitchen is my territory."
She sat down looking at their eyes. It wasn't easy. The TV lights were already on. She made the extra effort. Plummer she liked. Donner was hiding something. The realization made her blink, and her face changed over to her doctor's look. She had the sudden desire to say something to Jack, but there wasn't. "1 minute," the producer said. Andrea Price, as always, was in the room, standing by the door to the secretary's space, and the door behind Kathy was open to the corridor. Jeff Raymond was there. He was another odd duck, Kathy thought. But the problem with the White House was that everyone treated you like you were Julius Caesar or something. It was so hard just being friendly with people. It seemed that there was always something in the way. Fundamentally, neither Jack nor Kathy was used to having servants. Employees, yes, but not servants. She was popular with her nurses and technicians at Hopkins because she treated them all like the professionals they were, and she was trying to do the same thing here. But for some reason it didn't work quite the same way, and that was bothersome in a distant way. 15 seconds.
"Are we having fun yet?" Jack whispered.
"Why couldn't you just have stayed at Merrill Lynch?" Kathy almost said aloud. "He would have been a senior VP by now. But no, he would never have been happy. Jack was as driven to do his work as she was to fix people's eyes. In that, they were the same."
"Good evening," Donner said to the camera behind the Ryans. "We're here in the Oval Office to speak with President Jack Ryan and the First Lady. As I said on NBC Nightly News, a technical glitch damaged the taping we did earlier today. The President has graciously allowed us to come back and talk live." His head turned. "And for that, sir, we thank you." "Glad to see you again, Tom," the President said comfortably. He was getting better at concealing his thoughts. "Also joining us is Mrs. Ryan."
"Please," Kathy said with a smile of her own. "It's Dr. Ryan. I worked pretty hard for that."
"Yes, ma'am," Donner said with a charm that made Kathy think about a bad trauma case rolling off on Monument Street at lunchtime. "You're both doctors, aren't you?"
"Yes, Mr. Donner, Jack in history and me in ophthalmology."
"And you're a distinguished eye surgeon with the Lasker Public Service Award," he observed, applying his anchorman's charm.
"Well, I've been working in medical research for over 15 years. At Johns Hopkins, we're all clinicians and researchers, too. I work with a wonderful group of people, and really, the Lasker Prize is more a tribute to them than it is to me. Back 15 years ago, Professor Bernard Katz encouraged me to look into how we could use lasers to correct various eye problems. I found it interesting, and I've been working in that area ever since, in addition to my normal surgical practice."
"Do you really make more money than your husband?" Donner asked with a grin for the cameras.
"Lots," she confirmed with a chuckle.
"I always said that Kathy was the brains of the outfit," Jack went on, patting his wife's hand. "She's too modest to say that she's just about the best in the world at what she does." "So, how do you like being First Lady?"
"Do I have to answer?"
A charming smile. Then she turned serious.
"The way we got here, well, it's not something anyone would wish for. But I guess it's like what I do at the hospital. Sometimes a trauma case comes in, and that person didn't choose to be injured, and we try our best to fix what's wrong. Jack's never turned away from a problem or a challenge in his life."
Then it was time for business. "Mr. President, how do you like your job?"
"Well, the hours are pretty long. As much time as I have spent in government service, I don't think I ever really understood how difficult this job is. I am blessed with a very fine staff, and our government has thousands of dedicated workers doing the public's business. That helps a lot."
"As you see it, sir, what is your job?" John Plummer asked.
"The oath says to preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution of the United States," Ryan replied. "We're working to restore the government. We now have the Senate fully in place, and as the several states get on with their elections, we'll soon have a new House of Representatives. I've got most of the cabinet posts filled. For HHS and education, we still have the sitting deputy secretaries doing a fine job."
"We spoke this morning about events in the Persian Gulf. What are the problems there as you see them?"
It was Plummer again. Ryan was handling himself well, much more relaxed, and Plummer noted the look in his wife's eyes. She was smart. "The United States wants nothing more than peace and stability in that region. We have every wish to establish friendly relations with the new United Islamic Republic. There's been enough strife there and elsewhere in the world. I'd like to think that we've turned the corner on that. We've made peace, a real peace, not just the absence of war, with the Russians, after generations of turmoil. I want us to build on that. Maybe the world's never been fully at peace, but that is no reason why we can't do it. John, we've come a very long way in the past 20 years. There's a lot more for us to do, but we have a lot of good work to build on."
"We'll be back after this break," Donner told the cameras. He could see that Ryan was pretty pleased with himself. "Excellent." A staffer came in from the back door with water glasses. Everyone had a sip while they waited for the two commercials to run.
"You really hate all this, don't you?" he asked Kathy.
"As long as I can do my work, I can live with almost anything. But I do worry about the kids. After this is over, they have to go back to being normal children. And we didn't raise them for all this hoopla."
Then everyone was quiet for the rest of the commercial time. "We're back in the Oval Office with the President and First Lady." "Mr. President," Donner asked, "what about the changes you are making?" "Mainly, my job isn't a change, Tom. It's to restore. Along the way, we will try to do a few things. I've tried to select my new cabinet members with an eye toward making the government function more efficiently. As you know, I've been in government service for quite a while, and along the way I've seen numerous examples of inefficiency. The citizens out there pay a lot of money in taxes, and we owe it to them to see that the money is spent wisely and efficiently. So I've told my cabinet officers to examine all of the executive departments with an eye to doing the same work for less cost."
"A lot of presidents have said that."
"This one means it," Ryan said seriously.
"But your first major policy act has been to attack the tax system," Donner observed.
"Not attack, Tom. Change. George Winston has my full support. The tax code we have now is totally unfair, and I mean unfair in many ways. People can't understand it, for one. That means that they have to hire people to explain the tax system to them, and it's hard to see how it makes sense for people to pay good money for people to explain how the law takes more of their money away, especially when the government writes the laws. Why make laws that the people can't understand? Why make laws that are so complicated?" Ryan asked.
"But along the way, your administration's goal is to make the tax system regressive, not progressive."
"We've been over that," the president replied, and Donner knew he had him then. It was one of Ryan's more obvious weaknesses that he didn't like repeating himself. He really was not a politician. They love to repeat themselves. "Charging everyone the same amount is just as fair as anything can be. Doing so in a way that everyone can understand will actually save money for people. Our proposed tax changes will be revenue neutral. Nobody's getting any special breaks."
"But the tax rates for the rich will fall dramatically."
"That's true. But we'll also eliminate all the breaks that their lobbyists have written into the system. They'll actually end up paying the same, or more probably, a little more than they already do. Secretary Winston has studied that very carefully, and I concur in his judgment."
"Sir, it's hard to see how a 30% rate reduction will make them pay more. That's fourth-grade arithmetic."
"Ask your accountant," Ryan smiled. "Or, for that matter, look at your own tax returns if you can figure them out. You know, Tom, I used to be an accountant. I passed the exam before I went into the Marine Corps, and I can't even figure the darn things out. The government does not serve the public interest by doing things that the people can't understand. There's been too much of that. I'm going to try to dial it back a bit."
Bingo. To Donner's left, John Plummer grimaced. The director, with his selection of camera feeds, made sure that one didn't go out. Instead, he picked Donner's winning anchorman smile.
"I'm glad you feel that way, Mr. President, because there are many things that the American people would like to know about government operations. Nearly all of your government service has been in the Central Intelligence Agency."
"That's true, but, Tom, as I told you this morning, no president has ever spoken about intelligence operations. There's a good reason for that."
Ryan was still cool, not knowing what door had just opened.
"But, Mr. President, you have personally been involved in numerous intelligence operations which had important effects on bringing that end to the Cold War. For example, the defection of the Soviet missile submarine Red October. You played a personal part in that, didn't you?"
The director, cued ahead of time to the question, had selected the camera zeroed in on Ryan's face, just in time to see his eyes go as wide as doorknobs. He really wasn't all that good at controlling his emotions.
"Tom, the viewers should know that you played a decisive role in one of the greatest intelligence coups of all time. We got our hands on an intact Soviet ballistic missile submarine, didn't we?"
"I won't comment on that story."
By this time, his makeup couldn't hide the pale look. Kathy turned to look at her husband, having felt his hand in hers turn to ice. "And then, less than 2 years later, You personally arranged the defection of the head of the Russian KGB.
Jack managed to control his face, finally, but his voice was wooden.
Tom, this has to stop. You're making unfounded speculations.
Mr. President, that individual, Nikolai Gerasimov, formerly of the KGB, now lives with his family in Virginia. The captain of the submarine lives in Florida. It's not a story, he smiled, and you know it.
Sir, I don't understand your reticence. You played a major role in bringing that peace to the world that you talked about a few minutes ago.
Tom, let me make this clear. I will not ever discuss intelligence operations in any public forum, period.
But the American people have a right to know what sort of man sits in this office.
The same thing had been said 11 hours before by John Plummer, who winced inwardly to hear himself quoted in this way, but who could not turn on his own colleague in public. Tom, I have served my country to the best of my ability for a number of years, but just as you cannot reveal your news sources, so our intelligence agencies cannot reveal many of the things they do for fear of getting real people killed.
But, Mr. President, you have done that. You have killed people.
Yes, I have, and more than one president has been a soldier, or...
Wait a minute, Kathy interrupted, and now her eyes were flaring. I want to say something. Jack joined CIA after our family was attacked by terrorists. If he hadn't done those things back then, none of us would be alive. I was pregnant with our son then, and they tried to kill me and our daughter in my car in Annapolis, and...
Excuse me, Mrs. Ryan, but we have to take a break now.
This has to stop, Tom. This has to stop right now, Ryan said forcefully. When people talk about field operations in the open, real people can get killed. Do you understand that?
The camera lights were off, but the tapes were still rolling.
Mr. President, the people have a right to know, and it's my job to report the facts. Have I lied about anything?
I can't even comment on that, and you know it, Ryan said, having almost snarled an accurate answer.
Temper, Jack, temper, he reminded himself. A president can't have a temper. Damn sure not on live TV.
Damn, Marco would never cooperate with the...
Or would he?
He was Lithuanian, and maybe he might like the idea of becoming a national hero, though Jack figured he might just talk him out of such a thing. But Gerasimov was something else. Ryan had disgraced the man, threatened him with death, at the hands of his own countrymen. But that didn't matter to a man like him, and stripped him of all his power.
Gerasimov now enjoyed a life far more comfortable than anything he might have enjoyed in the Soviet Union, which he had sought to maintain and rule. But he wasn't the sort of man to enjoy comfort so much as power. Gerasimov had aspired to the sort of position Ryan now enjoyed himself, and would have felt very comfortable in this office or another like it. But those who aspired to power were most often those who misused it, which distinguished him from Jack in one more way. Not that it mattered at the moment. Gerasimov would talk, sure as hell. And they knew where he was. So what do I do now?
We're back in the Oval Office with President and Mrs. Ryan, Donner intoned for anyone who might have forgotten.
Mr. President, you are an expert in national security and foreign affairs, Plummer said before his colleague could speak. But our country faces more problems than that. You now have to re-establish the Supreme Court. How do you propose to do that?
I ask the Justice Department to send me a list of experienced judges from federal appeals courts. I'm going over that list now, and I hope to make my nominations to the Senate in the next 2 weeks.
Normally, the American Bar Association assists the government in screening such judges, but evidently that's not being done in this case. May I ask why, sir?
Tom, all of the judges on the list have been through that process already, and since then all have sat on the appeals bench for a minimum of 10 years.
The list was assembled by prosecutors, Donner asked.
By experienced professionals in the Justice Department. The head of the search group is Patrick Martin, who just took over the criminal division. He was assisted by other Justice Department officials, like the head of the Civil Rights Division, for example.
But they're all prosecutors, or people whose job it is to prosecute cases. Who suggested Mr. Martin to you?
It's true that I don't personally know the Department of Justice all that well. Acting FBI Director Murray recommended Mr. Martin to me. He did a good job supervising the investigation of the airplane crash into the Capitol building,
and I asked him to assemble the list for me. And you and Mr. Murray have been friends for a long time.
Yes, we have, Ryan nodded.
On another of those intelligence operations, Mr. Murray accompanied you, didn't he?
Excuse me? Jack asked.
The CIA operation in Colombia, when you played a role in breaking up the Medellin cartel.
Tom, I'm going to say this one last time. I will not discuss intelligence operations, real ones or made-up ones at all. Ever. Are we clear on that?
Mr. President, that operation resulted in the death of Admiral James Cutter.
Sir, Donner went on, a sincerely pained expression on his face. A lot of stories are coming out now about your tenure at CIA. These stories are going to break, and we really want you to have the chance to set the record straight as rapidly as possible. You were not elected to this office, and you have never been examined in the way that political candidates usually are. The American people want to know the man who sits in this office, sir.
Tom, the world of intelligence is a secret world. It has to be. Our government has to do many things. Not all of those things can be discussed openly. Everyone has secrets. Every viewer out there has them. You have them. In the case of the government, keeping those secrets is vitally important to the well-being of our country, and also, by the way, to the safety of the lives of the people who do our country's business. Once upon a time, the media respected that rule, especially in times of war, but also in other times. I wish you still did.
But at what point, Mr. President, does secrecy work against our national interests?
That's why we have a law that mandates Congress's right to oversee intelligence operations. If it were just the executive branch making these decisions, yes, you would have just cause to worry. But it isn't that way. Congress also examines what we do. I have myself reported to Congress on many of these things.
Was there a secret operation to Colombia? Did you participate in it? Did Daniel Murray accompany you there after the death of then-FBI Director Emil Jacobs?
I have nothing to say on that or on any of the other stories you brought up.
And there was another commercial break.
Why are you doing this?
To everyone's surprise, the question came from Kathy.
Mrs. Ryan.
Dr. Ryan, she said at once.
Excuse me, Dr. Ryan, these allegations must be laid to rest.
We've been through this before. Once people tried to break our marriage up, and that was all lies, too, and—
Kathy, Jack said quietly. Her head turned toward his.
I know about that one, Jack, remember? She whispered.
No, you don't. Not really.
That's the problem, Tom Donner pointed out. These stories will be followed up. The people want to know. The people have a right to know.
Had the world been just, Ryan thought, he would have stood, tossed the microphone to Donner, and asked him to leave his house. But that wasn't possible. And so here he was, supposedly powerful, trapped by circumstance like a criminal in an interrogation room. Then the camera lights came back on.
Mr. President, I know this is a difficult subject for you.
Tom, okay, I will say this. As part of my service with CIA, I occasionally had to serve my country in ways that cannot be revealed for a very long time. But at no time have I ever violated the law, and every such activity was fully reported to the appropriate members of the Congress. Let me tell you why I joined CIA.
I didn't want to. I was a teacher. I taught history at the Naval Academy. I love teaching, and I had time to write a couple of history books, and I like that too. But then a group of terrorists came after me and my family. There were two very serious attempts to kill us. All of us. You know that. It was all over the media when it happened. I decided then that my place was in the agency. Why? To protect others against the same sort of dangers. I never liked it all that much, but it was the job I decided I had to do. Now I'm here, and you know what? I don't much like this job either. I don't like the pressure. I don't like the responsibility. No one person should have this much power. But I am here, and I swore an oath to do my best, and I'm doing that.
But, Mr. President, you are the first person to sit in this office who's never been a political figure. Your views on many things have never been shaped by public opinion, and what is disturbing to a lot of people is that you seem to be leaning on others who have never achieved high office either. The danger, as some people see it, is that we have a small group of people who lack political experience, but who are shaping policy for our country for some time to come. How do you answer that concern?
I haven't even heard that concern anywhere, Tom.
Sir, you've also been criticized for spending too much time in this office and not enough out among the people. Could that be a problem?
Now that he'd sunk the hook, Donner could afford to appear plaintive.
Unfortunately, I do have a lot of work to do, and this is where I have to do that work.
For the team I've put together, where do I start? Jack asked.
Next to him, Kathy was seething. Now her hand felt cold in his. Secretary of State Scott Adler, a career Foreign Service officer, son of a Holocaust survivor. I've known Scott for years. He's the best man I know to run state.
Treasury George Winston, a self-made man. He was instrumental in saving our financial system during the conflict with Japan. He has the respect of the financial community, and he's a real thinker.
Defense, Anthony Brattano, is a highly successful engineer and businessman who's already making needed reforms at the Pentagon. FBI, Dan Murray, a career cop and a good one. You know what I'm doing with my choices, Tom. I'm picking pros, people who know the work because they've done it, not political types who just talk about it. If you think that's wrong, well, I'm sorry about that, but I've worked my way up inside the government, and I have more faith in the professionals I've come to know than I do in the political appointees I've seen along the way.
And oh, by the way, how is that different from a politician who selects the people he knows, or worse, people who contributed to his campaign organization?
Some would say that the difference is that ordinarily people selected to high office have much broader experience.
I would not say that, and I have worked under such people for years. The appointments I've made are all people whose abilities I know. Moreover, a president is supposed to have the right, with the assent of the people's elected representatives, to pick people he can work with.
But with so much to do, how do you expect to succeed without experienced political guidance? This is a political town.
Maybe that's the problem, Ryan shot back. Maybe the political process that we've all studied over the years gets in the way more than it helps.
Tom, I didn't ask for this job, okay? The idea, when Roger asked me to be vice president, was that I serve out the remaining term and leave government service for good. I wanted to go back to teaching. But then that dreadful event happened, and here I am. I am not a politician. I never wanted to be one, and as far as I'm concerned, I'm not a politician now.
Am I the best man for this job? Probably not. I am, however, the President of the United States, and I have a job to do, and I'm going to do it to the best of my ability. That's all I can do.
And that's the last word. Thank you, Mr. President.
Jack barely waited for the camera lights to go off a final time before unclipping the microphone from his tie and standing. The two reporters didn't say a word. Kathy glared at them.
Why did you do that?
Excuse me, Donna replied.
Why do people like you always attack people like us? What have we done to deserve it? My husband is the most honorable man I know.
All we do is ask questions.
Don't give me that. The way you ask them and the questions you choose, you give the answers before anyone has a chance to say anything.
Neither reporter responded to that. The Ryans left without another word. Then Arnie came in.
Okay, he observed. Who set this up?
They gutted him like a fish, Holbrook thought aloud. They were due for some time off, and it was always a good thing to know your enemy.
This guy's scary, Ernie Brown thought, considering things a little more deeply.
At least politicians you can depend on to be crooks. This guy, Jesus, he's going to try to... We're talking a police state here, Pete.
It was actually a frightening thought for the mountain man. He'd always thought that politicians were the worst thing in creation. But suddenly he realized that they were not. Politicians played the power game because they liked it, liked the idea of power and jerking people around because it made them feel big. Ryan was worse. He thought it was right.
God damn, he breathed. The court he wants to appoint.
They made him look like a fool, Ernie.
No, they didn't. Don't you get it?
They were playing their game.
Chapter 33. Rebounds.
The editorials were established by front-page stories in every major paper. In the more enterprising of them, there were even photographs of Marco Ramius's house. It turned out that he was away at the moment, and that of the Gerasimov family. He was home, but a security guard managed to persuade people to leave, after getting his own photo shot a few hundred times. Donner came into work very early, and was actually the most surprised by all of that. Plummer walked into his office 5 minutes later, holding up the front page of the New York Times.
"So, who rolled whom, Tom?"
"What are you—" "That's a little weak," Plummer observed acidly. "I suppose after you walked out of the meeting, Keelty's people had another little cafe-clatch. But you've trapped everybody, haven't you? If it ever gets out that your tape wasn't—"
"It won't," Donner said.
"And all this coverage does is make our interview look better."
"Better to whom?" Plummer demanded on his way out the door.
It was early in the day for him, too, and his first irrelevant thought of the day was that Ed Murrow would never have used hairspray. Dr. Gus Lorenz finished his morning staff meeting early. Spring was coming early to Atlanta. The trees and bushes were budding, and soon the air would be filled with the fragrances of all the flowering plants for which the southern city was so famous. And a lot of pollen, Gus thought, which would get his sinuses all stuffed. But it was a fair trade for living in a vibrant and yet gracious southern city. With the meeting done, he donned his white lab coat and headed off to his own special fiefdom in the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. CDC, and P had never been added to the acronym, was one of the government's crown jewels, an elite agency that was one of the world's important centers of medical research. Many would say the most important. For that reason, the center in Atlanta attracted the best of the profession. Some stayed. Some left to teach at the nation's medical schools, but all were forever marked as CDC people, as others might boast of having served their time in the Marine Corps, and for much the same reason. They were the first people their country sent to trouble spots. They were the first to fight diseases, instead of armed enemies. And that cachet engendered an esprit de corps which more often than not retained the best of them, despite the capped government salaries. "Morning, Melissa," Lauren said to his chief lab assistant. She had a master's and was finishing up her doctorate in molecular biology at nearby Emory University, after which she'd get a sizable promotion.
"Good morning, Doctor. Our friend is back," she added.
"Oh?"
The specimen was all set up on the microscope. Lauren took his seat, careful as always to take his time. He checked the paperwork to identify the proper sample against the record he'd had on his desk. 98-3-063-A. Yes, the numbers matched. Then it was just a matter of zooming in on the sample. And there it was, the shepherd's crook.
"You're right. Got the other one set up?"
"Yes, doctor."
The computer screen split into two vertical halves, and next to the first was a specimen from 1976. They weren't quite identical. The curve at the bottom of the RNA chain was seemingly never the same way twice, as snowflakes had almost infinite patterns. But that didn't matter. What mattered was the protein loops at the top, and those were Myinga strain. He spoke the words matter-of-factly.
"I agree," Melissa said from just behind him.
She leaned across to type on the keyboard, calling up 063B.
"These were a lot harder to isolate, but—"
"Yes, identical again.
This one's from the child?" "A little girl, yes."
Both voices were detached. One can only bear so much exposure to sadness before the mind's defense mechanism kicks in, and the samples become samples, disembodied from the people who donated them.
"Okay, I have some calling to do."
The two groups were kept separate for obvious reasons, and in fact neither knew of the existence of the other. But Drine spoke to one group of 20. The movie star spoke to the second group, composed of 9. For both groups,
there were similarities of preparation. Iran was a nation-state with the resources of a nation-state. Its foreign ministry had a passport office, and its treasury had a department of printing and engraving. Both allowed the printing of passports from any number of countries and the duplication of entry-exit stamps. In fact, such documents could be prepared in any number of places, mostly illegally, but this source made for somewhat higher quality without the risk of revealing the place of origin. The more important of the two missions was, perversely, the safer in terms of actual physical danger. Well, depending on how one looked at it. Badrine could see the looks on their faces. The very idea of what they were doing was the sort of thing to make a person's skin crawl. Though, in the case of these people, it was merely one more example of the vagaries of human nature. The job, he told them, was simple. Get in, deliver, get out. He emphasized that they were completely safe as long as they followed the procedures on which they would be fully briefed. There would be no contacts on the other side. They needed none, and doing without them just made things safer. Each had a choice of cover stories, and such were the parameters of the mission that having more than one of the group select the same one didn't matter. What did matter was that the stories could be plausibly presented, and so each traveler would pick a field of business activity in which he had some knowledge. Nearly all had a university degree, and those who didn't could talk about trading or machine tools or some field better known to them than any customs official asking questions out of mere boredom. The movie star's group was far more comfortable with their task. He supposed it was some flaw in the character of his culture that this was so. This group was younger and less experienced, and part of it was that the young simply know less of life, and therefore less of death. They were motivated by passion, by a tradition of sacrifice, and by their own hatreds and demons, all of which clouded their judgment in a way that pleased the masters, who always felt free to expend the hatreds and the passions, along with the people who bore them. This briefing was more detailed. Photographs were displayed, along with maps and diagrams, and the group drew closer, the better to see the details. None of them remarked on the character of the target. Life and death was so simple a question to those who didn't know the ultimate answers, or who thought they did, even if they did not. And that was better for all, really. With an answer to the great question fixed in their minds, the lesser ones would not even occur to them. The movie star had no such illusions. He asked the questions within his own mind, but never answered them. For him, the great question had become something else. For him, it was all a political act, not a matter of religion, and one didn't measure one's destiny by politics, at least not willingly. He looked at their faces, knowing that they were doing exactly that, but without realizing it. They were the best sort of people for the task, really. They thought they knew everything, but in reality they knew very little, only the physical tasks. The movie star felt rather like a murderer, but it was something he'd done before, at second hand anyway. Doing it first hand was dangerous, and this promised to be the most dangerous such mission in years. How remarkable that they didn't know better. Each of them inwardly styled himself the stone in Allah's own sling, without reflecting that such stones are by their very nature thrown away. Or maybe not. Perhaps they would be lucky. And for that eventuality, he gave them the best data he'd managed to generate, and that data was pretty good. The best time would be afternoon, just before people got out from work, the better to use crowded highways to confuse their pursuers. He himself would go into the field again, he told them, to facilitate their ultimate escape. He didn't tell them, if it came to that.
"Okay, Arnie, what's going on?" Ryan asked. It was just as well that Kathy didn't have any procedures scheduled for today. She had seethed all night and was not in a proper mental state to do her normal work. He wasn't feeling much better, but there was neither justice nor much point in snapping at his chief of staff.
Well, for damn sure there's a leak at CIA, or maybe in the Hill, somebody who knows about some of the things you did. Columbia, the only people who know are Fellows and Trent.